Hello and welcome to the third OIES Energy Podcast. My name is James Henderson. I'm Director of the Gas Programme at OIES. And I'm here today with Tricia Curtis, who's a visiting fellow and also President and co-founder of Petronerds, which is a boutique research oil and gas consulting company based in Denver. We're here today to talk about Tricia's latest paper for OIES called Completion Design Changes and the Impact on US Shale Productivity. Tricia, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Sure.
I guess the first question I'd like to ask you, if I may, before we get into the detail of the paper, is how you go about actually collecting your research and data and what the process is in terms of your analysis of the shale industry in the US.
Yeah, so it's a lot of different things. So my day-to-day is researching and getting into the weeds. So it's not just, it isn't just one or two things for the paper. It's pulling in all of my research together. But I spend a lot of time talking with operators. For this report, I spent a lot of time talking with engineers, those completion engineers that I could meet with. I spoke with them, and we spent a lot of time also with the data and reconciling the data with what the public statements are from a lot of publicly traded companies.
Okay, interesting. So in terms of the paper then, obviously, you start off by going through a few of the shale plays and their performance over the past 12 to 18 months. Could you just talk us through the different plays and what you see?
Yeah, so I mean, we've seen production levels obviously increase in the Permian Basin. So that's the, South Texas, West Texas and Southern New Mexico. Production has continued to increase. Productivity has continued to increase a little more so on the Texas side. And we're seeing that regardless of sort of lateral length. So we're seeing productivity gains going forward. And then we really see a pretty big bump in the Williston Basin in North Dakota and in the Eagle Ford Reservoir in southern Texas. And both of those plays, the production has sort of flatlined, but the actual productivity gains per well have grown. So the output per well in the first several months of production has really grown. And we're seeing those gains even in the smaller plays like the Denver-Julesburg Basin in Colorado and the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. We're seeing those gains as well.
Okay, I mean, but the Permian Basin is the kind of big one.
It is
the mother, if you like. Yeah. I mean, what's happening there? What specifically is causing that production to ramp up?
Well, it's the same with the other plays as well. So all these high intensity completions are sort of the most simplistic way of explaining of the massive proppant loadings and the massive quantities of fluid that are being pumped down the well at very fast rates and high pressures is essentially what's unlocking this. But that's being applied across the board. And there's some nuances that we talk about in the paper of the unknowns, but simplistically it's these intense completions that are breaking it.
I mean, in the paper you mentioned completions as the kind of the major driver, but that seems to be a pretty kind of broad concept. Can you kind of start to unpack it a little bit for us and talk us about some of the specific things that are happening which are increasing well performance?
Absolutely. So your completions are only going to be, I mean, you can have a great completion, but it's only going to be amazing if you know the geology, if you have a good understanding of the rocks, if the geology is decent, if you are delineating your assets, your acreage, and you put all this front-loading work into it. We have seen sort of the brute force mentality where you pump a lot of sand and you pump a lot of fluid and you're getting production increases. But obviously, the better you know your assets and the real sort of nuances that over the past few years, operators are better understanding their geology, significantly better. So they're applying their own tweaks and methods in addition to sort of that simplistic, intense completion that's really unlocking it for them. And when you start looking at individual operators and looking at their completions or looking at their production and their productivity growth, you really start to see some evidence of this.
So just to sort of get down into the weeds a little bit, you talk in the paper about different types of sands and different granularity of sands that are being used. You talk about different proppants that are being used and different types of liquids that are going. How much do the operators, is this just going to try and trial and error? Or what is it, for example, about the sand that is kind of creating the kind of the new dynamic, if you like?
Well, I'll be completely honest, it is controversial. So for me to say in the paper when I went sort of many rounds of how I was going to address sand and whether or not it was the different types were contributing to productivity gains. And when you speak with some engineers and some operators, they don't think that the size matters at all, whereas other operators do, and other completion engineers do think that the size of the sand matters. But that's where every operator is different, right? So we mentioned this in the paper that no two companies are really alike on saying this is the greatest thing ever, we're going to do this. It really depends on their reservoir, depends on their how they're designing their completions and what they decide. But that being said, there has been a wave of some operators that have favored the sort of smaller mesh sand size, and that smaller mesh, it's partly become popular because they are actually mining and producing it in the Permian Basin. And while some folks are saying, well, that's just going to be a flash in the pan, and maybe we don't want that small sand size and it's not really going to work, if the prices of that sand come down, it may become a little more favorable. And as these mines open up in western Texas, we may see the price of 100 mesh come down a bit, and I think that could increase the usage a bit.
So you're saying it's kind of a bit opportunistic, and I mean, you mentioned the paper, and I guess we all kind of understand about shale, there's as much art as there is science. So is it possible to say how far down the learning curve we are about this stuff, or is it really kind of just a random process?
I don't think it's completely random. I think that we often folks often lump shale together and just say, well, want to put a dot in where it's at on that learning curve, and you can't really do that because every operator and with their individual assets is in a different point on that curve. So top operators may be further along that curve in one play or one part of their play, but behind in a different one, and they're applying that knowledge to the other one. So it is a bit of it is guess and check. I mean, they're learning things and applying them, but that's also a positive because the nature of the industry is extremely nimble and flexible, and they've had the opportunity to do that sort of guess and check. Now, that might be changing a little bit with increased financial pressure, but I would just caution folks to call the industry down and out because I think they'll ultimately prevail through it.
And what's happening with the different companies? Are there some that are definitive leaders in developing the science and others are natural followers? I mean, I guess some of the smaller companies, I guess, are following on, or is it just not possible to make that kind of...
No, I think there's some that are certainly leaders. I mean, we're seeing it. I mentioned EOG in the paper is clearly a leader. There's not many people who would really disagree with that. They're producing well over 300,000 barrels a day of production right now, and they've really sort of led the learning curve in the Bakken, in the Eagle Ford, and they're doing it in the Permian Basin as well. So and actually in the Powder River in Wyoming. So they're making some big advances, but there are a lot of other companies. And I hate to just point to one because there are a lot of other companies that are doing it. The smaller operators, even the public ones, don't often want to tell you as much. So it's in, you know, EOG has spent a lot of time in their recent earnings talking about their technology and how they're applying it and all the apps they have that they're using on their phones. And that's all great. But not every operator is going to tell you all that, even though they may be doing very similar things. And there is something to be said about, well, we're close to where EOG is at. Our acreage looks roughly the same or our geology might be similar. And so we're going to apply similar techniques. And oh, by the way, it works. So you do have some follow the leader mentality. And that usually, I mean, we had that prior to the downturn. We have had it during the downturn, and we'll continue to have it. But it's not just operators like EOG that are setting the tone. There's several others out there, and they vary according to state and oil play.
Okay. I mean, just going back to the stuff that's going down the well, I mean, you talked a bit about sand. You mentioned in the paper some different liquids that are being used as well. Is that just a kind of combination with the sand? Is that how important is that relative to other issues?
I think it's pretty important, and I think the operators have preferences depending on which play they're in and what's working best and how they're deciding to pump that. I think service providers probably also have a preference on how they're doing it. You are seeing a vast amount of slick water jobs, so they, you know, maybe you're using a hybrid before. And it was more gel-based, and they were using bigger sand or different types of proppant. And when you started using, with the downturn, there was a resurgence in massive slickwater jobs because it was just simply cheaper, and you were pumping cheap sand. But I would say I've heard of operators using more cross-linked, so there's sort of a bit of a hybrid between. And I think it really just depends on the operator preference, what type of service company they're using, and what's working best for them at the time.
Just for the amateur, can you just tell us what slickwater is?
Yeah, I mean, simplistically, it's just it's a water and a little bit of chemicals. It's less viscous. So it's if you're using more of a gel or a hybrid, you're increasing the viscosity, which you typically use to take a ceramic proppant or a more dense proppant to take it and fracture with. And the slick water is basically just think of it as simplistically water with a little bit of chemicals and taking sand. You don't need it as viscous to carry that sand.
Okay. I mean, historically, of course, we've all been watching well counts and numbers of wells drilled. You touch on that in the paper. I mean, in terms of wells being drilled and also well spacing, which is a kind of, is that slightly old school now, or is that still a critical thing to continue watching?
No, I think wells being, the number of wells being drilled is, I mean, it's almost like we don't know, the rig count is sort of irrelevant. The number of wells being drilled and completed is, obviously you should watch that for production, but spacing is still being, is still a big sort of question mark in lots of different plays. So the best, operators are trying to delineate their assets and figure out what's the best acreage spacing. So how close can I put these wells together according to how I'm completing them? And that sort of is, you're moving things here and there of, do I change the completion this way and put the wells closer together, or do I put them further away and then do maybe a bigger completion job? So it, that's still really, I think, being teased out and in terms of what's the ultimate spacing. And that, that comes in play with what's the ultimate completion as well.
Tied to that, there's also the length of the wells, which you talk about here as well. I mean, wells are getting longer. Is that making life more difficult in terms of the fracking, or is the technology how's the technology improving there?
No, I don't think there's a significant obstacle if your wells are longer. The biggest obstacle in making your wells longer is having the continuous acreage positions to do so. So as these plays have developed, operators have had the access to that. They've accrued the acreage, put it together, and they can drill longer laterals. A lot of people would say, well, they're just drilling longer laterals, and therefore that's what's increasing the productivity. And that's true. Your longer laterals are definitely helping you increase your output. But you have to you still have to be in good geology and good rock. You still have to have a good understanding of that rock, and so you have to complete it well in order to get that increased output. And then when we look in the Permian Basin in particular, if we break it up by lateral length, we can see that regardless of the lateral length, productivity is still increasing. And impressively enough, the lateral lengths aren't that long on average in the Permian. They're still under 7,000 feet, I think, on average. In 2017, they actually dropped a little bit. So that the productivity is still increasing. So it's not just lateral length that's doing it. And partly because the Midland side, the sort of the right side, or the right foot, I call it, of the basin is more developed, and so those laterals tend to be longer, whereas the Delaware side, the Delaware Basin, is still in sort of that severe development mode, and those laterals tend to be shorter.
And so what you're saying basically is that as the wells get longer, the productivity at kind of at the end of the well, the furthest away from the wellbore, if you like, is still as good as it is near the wellbore.
Yeah, it has been. And I wouldn't say that's not going to be for every operator. The execution on that really matters, but we have seen, I think, it's gotten a lot better.
Okay. The other thing you touch on is the kind of different opinions on frac size. So, I mean, I guess talking about, wider fracs, but closer to the well, or longer, thinner fracs. I mean, is that just a kind of currently in the sort of artistic phase, if you like?
It's in the vernacular. I think it's extremely controversial. And when you talk to operators about that, most people say you have no idea what that frac is doing, how big it is. But they are still attempting to sort of explain what they're doing. And that image that I put in there, and if you look up other completion design images, you can see where the operators are sort of giving you an image of keeping that fracture close to the wellbore and shortening those fracs. And Centennial Resources, as I mentioned in there, does talk about that sort of fatter frac. Technically speaking, it's very hard to prove that you're doing that because you don't have perfect mapping technology. Microseismic imaging helps, or tracers help, but it's not perfect. So to really know exactly where that fracture is going, and most importantly, to know what part of the fracture is contributing to production, that's still very much unknown. And I think that that's one of the big takeaways from this paper, is that we have a lot of known unknowns, and those to us at Petronerds bode extremely well for increased productivity in the future.
Okay. I'm going to come on to the kind of investor reaction in a minute, but just from a purely technical perspective, we talked about it's difficult to know where we are on the learning curve. But if you were kind of making an assessment, the improvements we've seen over the last 12 to 18 months from a technical perspective, do you think there's much further to go? I mean, is the industry perspective that there's a lot more learning to come? Or actually, do you think we're somewhere near the kind of end of the line?
No, I think the learning side, there's a lot more learning. I think that road is we can't, there's not really an end in sight in terms of the learning curve. Now, the actual productivity gains that you can accomplish in the near term with some of those financial implications and everything, that's a little bit more questionable. So operators are really starting to, are being pushed to look at how they're doing practices differently because of increased capital discipline or pressure on them. And I think that's that could curtail it. And you also have to be thinking about just the future in general of these assets. And so the learning curve in terms of learning more about the rocks and being able to complete them better, I think that's we'll continue along that path. But you have to also think about the types of management structures and which operators are going to invest in that and push that forward.
Yeah, you have quite a scary graph showing the negative free cash flow generated by companies over the last, I think, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And you talk about, obviously, in a low oil price environment, how capital discipline is becoming more urgent, a necessity. And you also talk about investor reaction and demands. Do you think that's going to be the biggest constraint over the next few years in terms of where productivity gains go?
I think that, obviously, we don't spend a whole lot of time talking about oil prices in the paper because it's almost a side that this has all happened sort of in a downturn. But oil prices are important, that if prices sort of push up and service costs and inflation pressures kick up, that can impact the industry and their ability to sort of put more sand down the well and put more fluid and keep pushing this. And also, spending the time and effort and money. But the financial side is that over the past few months, we've seen this sort of kick up in investor scrutiny of that, you know, Wall Street's pushing these guys to, they want more, they want return to the shareholders. And these operators have, for, you know, the past few years, haven't been pushed on that as hard as they might, maybe should have been. So the capital discipline wasn't necessarily there. They could burn through the cash and they could work on their assets. And now they're sort of trying to rein that in. We're seeing, I think, the biggest impact on some of the bigger E&Ps. And I'm a little bit more hesitant to say how quickly that's going to translate directly into this sort of smaller and mid-cap E&Ps. They're not, we've had third quarter earnings come out. They didn't seem to be massively penalized. Some of them, the negative free cash flow actually increased, and their stock didn't, you know, tank 20 or 30%. So I think that's going to take a couple quarters to sort of marinate through.
Okay. But to conclude on that, do you think that productivity gains are going to be inhibited from where they could have been over the next sort of couple of years because companies are going to have to focus on what they're doing with their cash more intently than they were before?
So for some operators that might. So for some operators, I think it could definitely hurt them. And I think they're going to have trouble on executing a more capitalist disciplined approach. For other operators, this might be an incentive to kick that up and kick it into gear. Because if you can get your spending in order and you can still increase your output, that's really going to set you apart from your peers. And I think there's still a goal there for a lot of operators. And I think some analysts, I think, are a little incorrect on thinking that the street's just going to want capital discipline. I think they also want growth. It's not going to be the same levels of growth we had in years past, but they still want some growth. These operators aren't going to be able to drop their production levels and, you know, give money back to shareholders. I don't think that's the perfect scenario. They want some growth, and they want that discipline in. So it's going to push these operators to be more efficient than they have been in the past.
Okay. Couple of last questions. I mean, you mentioned and rising oil prices and the potential for that to cause inflation in the service industry. I mean, how is the service industry doing and how has it done over the past kind of 12 to 18 months? And what do you think the reaction of the service industry is going to be going forward?
I think it depends on which service company you're talking to. And we know some of Schlumberger's comments in the paper, and they seem to be a little hard on the U.S. shale sector, but at the same time, they criticize them, but at the same time, they're also making money from them. And whereas if you look at other service providers, they are still trying to push their costs up. So I think a lot of the service sector is still trying to get their costs back up. They're not going to get to 2014 levels, but they're trying to get it closer to that point. And these operators are feeling the pinch right now. We've heard that from earnings calls. We've heard it in press releases that the cost inflation is important. I mean, EOG mentions it specifically that they're keeping some of their services now because they're a little concerned about the tightness in going into 2018. That all depends on oil prices and activity levels. So if you have a drop off in activity levels or a dip in oil prices, that could go by the wayside. So I think the service operators need to be very cautious on how they're increasing those costs to these operators, because it could, it could really hurt them if they push this too fast.
Interesting. One final concluding question to bring it all together. Given the productivity gains you've talked about, given the financial pressures we're under, what's your outlook for the US shale oil, you know, production levels over the next kind of 2 years, you know, short term, basically?
I think the short term is it's relatively robust. I don't think we're going to see bang up production levels this year. In 2017, we've averaged about just over 40,000 barrels a day per month growth. So if we do back of the envelope calculation and look at that for 2018, and we say let's just cut it to 25,000 barrels a day, that means we have plenty of months where we can grow, plenty of months where we don't, or maybe it's actually even drops. That means U.S. production exits the year at 9.6 million barrels per day. That puts us back at our 2015 highs. I think that's pretty substantial. It means that you have to continue to see stocks drawing around the world. There's a lot of implications. So it's sort of, you know, it's adding a few hundred thousand barrels a day. And that's not huge. I think that's a pretty conservative number, and that's doable. I think some of the bigger implications for this are that, you know, you can look at this paper and say, well, does that mean you'll have asset purchases and you'll have assets changing hands? And I think that could be one implication, except, you know, do investors want that either? So if these companies start buying other companies, are they going to get penalized? And we could be sort of, depending on the investor scrutiny, we could be sort of in a freeze hold, in a bit of a, everything's just frozen in time for a moment. And the operators are going to have to navigate through that.
And one last question. How dependent is it on oil prices? You've talked about it. I mean, obviously it's important, but are there threshold levels at which you'd expect to see a surge in production? Are there sort of downside levels in which you'd see kind of activity really curtailed?
Well, I think hedging activity has been pretty robust. So I think that if prices dropped into the high 40s, I mean, that's going to impact some operators. But I think you're looking at pretty sustainable activity levels. If prices go back into the mid 40s, I think in tandem with that investor scrutiny, things could get a little messy and you'll see a pullback. To be quite honest, the Permian has went way harder than it should have throughout 2017. The rig count completely decoupled from oil prices, you know, I think late in 2016. It's been overheated, and that's causing cost inflation in the service sector that really isn't translating to the rest of the oil plays, which are also seeing activity levels.
Okay, Tricia, thank you very much indeed. That's a really interesting conversation, and it's a very interesting paper, which you can find at our website at www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye to everyone.